For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Are you a creative who just wrapped up your independent film, new book, or album release? Or are you just looking for help on your fundraising campaign? Well, then you're gonna need a marketing strategy.
Smart House is a marketing agency that specializes in creative projects and independent films. They provide digital strategies, social media support, publicity services, branding, and fundraising strategies to help indie artists just like you.
Smart House was founded to help indie artists with all budgets find their audience and bring their projects to the world. Smart House has helped a ton of artists reach their goals, including the Making Movies is Hard podcast.
That's right. They're helping us grow our audience, and they can help you too. Go to smarthousecreative.com to get started today.
You know, making movies is hard.
Making movies is hard.
Welcome. This is the podcast about the struggle of being an independent filmmaker. I'm Mark Bassell, the founding host of the podcast. I'm a sci-fi horror filmmaker, and my first feature film, The Alternate, is out now on digital, DVD, and Tubi.
I'm Liz Manischel. I'm a writer, director, producer who has made two features, Bread and Butter and Speed of Life, and I'm currently making another one called Best Friends Forever. I'm a distribution consultant who does sales, and I used to manage Sundance's Creative Distribution Initiative. But this week, we welcome filmmaker Jay Shim on the show to talk about making his first feature film, Opus Cope, about composer and author David Cope, who spent his life teaching computers how to make music. Jay talks about how he discovered David and his work, and how he formed his first feature blending documentary and fiction together through the film. After that, we play another round of You're the Expert. I don't have a voice for that. You're the Expert. But first, Alric, how are you?
I'm doing good, I guess. I feel like last week was crazy because I was like super sick. And yeah, then I basically didn't really do anything at all towards anything. Yeah, I'm basically just still thinking about writing. Like, I really thought that I was going to write last week. Like, I was like, oh man, this is going to happen. And then it didn't. But yeah, you know, basically don't have a lot to talk about update wise. One thing that's happening that I haven't talked about at all is somebody reached out to me from Atlanta who saw The Alternate on Tubi and was like, hey, I've got this comic book. Like, I want you to write the feature length script of this comic book and help me make this. And ooh, we did this short film version of it a few years ago. That was cool. And then, you know, it was cool. He wasn't very happy with it because like the writer director of that like changed things a lot. And I was like, okay, like I can see why things are different. But basically, like, he's got two issues of this comic book that I'm reading, and then he's got like three or four more that he doesn't have into comic book form, but he just has written out the story. And so I'm trying to like go through this stuff to read it to like find what the story is here and like what I can do with this thing. And it's just taking me forever, man. Like, I just am so busy. Like, I'll read like a couple panels, and then I'll get through a little bit, and then, you know, and he keeps on, he's so sweet. He'll email me every week, and like sometimes he'll call me and just, you know, check in. And I like really want to help this guy out with this movie, but it's like, they basically has nothing, you know, he doesn't have any like script or outline or anything. Like, he just has this, the idea for the comic book. And it's like pretty massive. It's got two different stories, like one on an alien planet, one on Earth. And it's really cool, especially the alien planet story. But it's like, man, you know, like, we're so far away from like being a thing. It's kind of like, I don't know, do I want to even go down this road? You know, but like,
no.
Part of me is, yeah, no. Part of me is like, well, why not? Like, at least explore it and see where it goes, see if there's something there. But I mean, I guess your take is like, don't do it unless there's money involved, right? Like, don't.
Or if this person is just so fun to talk to and hang out with that you're like, hey, I'm okay that I'm not being paid right now because I derive something else from this experience.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. But yeah, we'll see what happens with it. You know, I think eventually I will get through and read it all. I think for the most part, yeah, it's just, I don't know. It's just too big, I think, you know, and it's like, it's kind of like a Superman-ish type thing, you know, which I think you could scale down to like making like a smaller budget movie or like something with it. But in a lot of ways, it's just too big. But it's still fun to be like wanted by somebody, even
right.
if they don't have
I was
any
about
money.
To say, like, the flattering part of it is really compelling, right? Like that someone reached out to you and they want you and they see something in you. But no, I don't do it, Ulrich. That's my ultimate advice.
Don't do it. Back away slowly.
Back away slowly, or say, you know, or buy yourself time and say, like, hey, if you get me an outline of what you think you're looking for in a writer, like that buys you some time and puts a little bit of work on their plate before it goes on your plate entirely. Like, it just seems like there's too much of a burden on you for a stranger right. to put on you, and without payment and without kind of any sort of promise of this film being made in any way, shape, or form. Like, it just right. seems like so many questions. But yeah, if you derive some sort of joy, then do it. I mean, this, I have this question I'm asking myself lately, inspired by a colleague of mine. And it's like, how does it serve you? How does this task serve you in the long run? Right. Mm-hmm. And I think we kind of tell ourselves stories of like, well, I'm needed, or I'm wanted, or they like me, or I'm doing something to take something off someone's plate, or whatever it is. But ultimately, does it serve a bottom line? And that might be a cold way to evaluate your life, but the bottom line can be joy. Does it serve you living a joyful existence? Then it doesn't feel so cold and sterile and capitalistic.
Right.
I think I came to a little bit of this distance because I took my first trip by myself this past weekend.
Wow.
In years, which anyone who listens to the podcast might know is a huge deal, because I've been a little recluse hiding away with my family since the pandemic. But I took a trip to the Bay Area to see my family, and I went solo, and it was like, oh, hey, I need to hail a lift by myself, and I could fix a vacuum cleaner by myself. It was all these things that I like had never done for the past few years. It was just really nice to remind myself that I'm actually a strong, independent person. And then it caused me, you know, and to kind of audit some of the way I spend my time. And I really want to do more things by myself. So I'm trying to do more things by myself. And also, I'm trying to make more money. These are my priorities for the next year is independence and moolah.
Is this the first alone trip you've had without your son, like, ever? Or is this just like the first one in a long time? Or
it's the first one ever that wasn't for work.
Wow.
Yeah. So in 4 years, the only trips I took away from my son were for work, when I absolutely had to. When Sundance was like, you have to come. And I was like, but I don't want to. And they're like, you have to. And so I said, okay. So yeah, this was a very, very big deal. But it was like such a nice wake up call. Like, I don't have to feel guilty about leaving my son for a few days.
Yeah. Beth just had her first one away from our daughter, I think in January. And she went to see her family for the weekend. And, you know, it's funny. It's like she's almost two, and it's the first time she'd ever left at all. You know, I think she enjoyed it. And it was like, you know, nice to have some just time being with her family where she wasn't having to also, you know, change a diaper.
Yeah. That's
and
wonderful.
Then, you know, yeah. But I don't know. I feel like it's interesting because especially you talk about like never wanting to leave your son. So that must have been a pretty big deal for you to like actually go.
It wasn't away. Even a question because, you know, I've got some family situation going on right now that I don't like even really want to talk about. But it kind of felt like, well, I have to go. And it would be more complicated if I brought my kid and my husband and create more stress for everyone. So it didn't even seem like a question. It's like, you know, you just do what you have to do. If it were, and we ran into this with Austin Film Festival, but also like I've had friends invite me on trips, things like that. And I'm always like, no, no way. Like, it's not even a question that I wouldn't go, right? So now I'm trying to say like, maybe it should be a question. Like, maybe I can say yes to some things, have a little bit more autonomy over my schedule and my life, and not just kind of do things because they're the way that they've been done for 4 years.
Yeah, I think that's healthy. Any movie updates of any kind that you want to talk about?
I am watching horror films all the time in order to prepare myself. I'm doing all the squishy creative stuff right now. So I'm spending my mornings before work doing squishy creative stuff. So that's the only update, really.
That's the best.
I guess so. It really is the most fun stuff, but it feels like the least productive because you're just like, oh, I'm just like dreaming and having a good time and thinking about how awesome this is going to be, right? So you feel like you should be suffering more is how I feel. Maybe you don't feel that way.
I feel like Steven Spielberg would say the dreaming part is the making the movies part. You know, he's always talking about how films are dreams and you make them reality. So,
well, he's healthy. He's healthier than I am.
Well, he's also not an independent filmmaker, so he doesn't really know what it really means.
He could afford to dream. He could afford to do it.
He could afford to do whatever. Exactly.
Speaking of affording things, can you afford a few dollars for your favorite podcast? If you can, don't forget to support us on Patreon, www.patreon.com/mmihpodcast. It is how we keep the show going and it is becoming more and more important every single day. We really would love the support. And also don't forget to check out our sponsor, Jambox.io, a royalty-free music and SFX company. They emphasize high-quality cinematic cues. They offer customized plans to fit your needs, and their composers have worked on soundtracks for Hollywood-level films, working with directors like Michael Bay, Martin Scorsese, or global brands like DJI. Without any more delay, here's our chat with Jay Shim.
All right, Jay, thank you so much for being on the show. Give us your elevator pitch for your film, Opus Cope.
Sure. Thanks for having me. Opus Cope is a music documentary film that's about AI composer David Cope and the ways in which humans and machines are creative. And it features excerpts from the first AI composed opera, which David composed in the late 80s and had performed in 1991, I believe, unbeknownst to the public at the time, because he didn't want people to know that it was composed by an algorithm.
Okay, there's 45 questions that I can't ask at the moment. How many days did you shoot?
It took, total filming time took between 2016 and 2019. It was filmed over the course of years. But in terms of actual days, I'd say close to 27.
Sorry, I lost my thing here.
Budget.
What was the rough budget for the film?
Rough budget, I'd say, I like to joke, was my budget. So I probably didn't even reach 10K. And this is including, I had edited the film myself. So, I mean, this was pretty as no budget, my budget as it gets.
I want to know how you met David Cope, but the question is, what was the origin of the idea? So if you could stuff in the meeting story in there, so my curiosity could be quelled. It's a very selfish desire that I'm putting out there in the world.
Yeah, I discovered David through a Radiolab podcast, actually, called Musical DNA. And they were playing the recomposed version of Beethoven's Moonlight Sonata. And I was so intrigued by it. You know, it felt like something out of a science fiction movie, it's stranger than fiction. And I just felt at the time this was something I had to look into further. And so I contacted David by email. And from the get-go, he was very generous and open, willing to share. After a few back and forth emails, I asked him if I could visit him in Santa Cruz for an initial interview. But he was always generous and game for anything, really. So the right timing, right place, right time, I want to say.
How long do you spend on working on the film from like when you initially heard, you know, him on the podcast to the movie coming out?
So I heard the podcast in 2016 and finished I Locked Picture in 2019, right before the Sundance deadline. That was just an arbitrary deadline that I set for myself. But at the time, I felt good about everything. And, you know, it's time to tie a knot in this and move on to the next project. But then as we all know, COVID happened and my festival kind of run would be delayed, kind of got stuck in limbo for a bit. but took the opportunity to connect with people who have been doing this for a lot longer than I have, getting the help of mentors and festival and distribution consultants.
It's so, I got to do a follow-up. Sorry, Arc, because this is too interesting. So for 4 years, from 2019 to 2023, did you open Picture at all? Or were you just getting advice from people about how to put it out into the world? Like, is the film the same today as it was in 2019?
I would say so, yes.
Wow, that's okay. And this is an interesting corollary that just is happenstance. That's our next question. If you could change one thing about the film in any way, what would it be?
I wish, well, it's more of a budget issue, but I'm pretty happy with it, to be honest. I wouldn't change a thing. This was kind of a reflection of where I was at the time and what I wanted to do creatively. So I've moved on, and that's kind of, you know, it opens up the door to pursuing perfection that I don't like to get stuck in. After a certain point, I'd like to say it's good enough. I did my best. I'm satisfied, and I don't see it too productive to think about stuff like that too much.
Can you talk a little bit about like your process for this documentary? Was it just you and a camera with the interview subject, or was there another way that you approached some of these the different shoots throughout the project?
Yeah, I mean, the process was very organic. What I thought was my process in the beginning eventually turned out to be different. I had an initial interview with David in 2016 and kind of, I had pieces of kind of a short documentary, but it wasn't focused in any kind of way. And as for a lot of documentaries, it's hard to find an angle to get in. And there's so much information. And so for me, going through this interview, I didn't feel at the time I had the pieces for an interesting film, the way that I wanted to tell it. So because originally I wanted this film to be a short film. I didn't even imagine it to be a feature, but it turned, I just, after that initial interview, I was like, there's no way that I can, a short film wouldn't do David justice. And I learned that no one had made a feature documentary on David. So subsequent visits to David, you know, it was just, it ended up just being me hanging out with David Cope more or less. And on one of these shoots, I just, you know, I told him, don't mind me. I'll film around you. Just let me just document what you're doing today and, you know, whatever you're working on at the moment. And David's, you know, he's always active and a prolific writer. So at the time he was working on a book, which was titled The Creative Machine. And it was his kind of reflections on what creativity is. And he was actually brainstorming at the time on like a sketch pad. And at that moment, I realized this is something. I learned myself that this film that I wanted to make was a film about creativity itself. It wasn't so much this literal AI music or this broad, you know, film about AI in general. It was this very.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Specific take on what creativity means from someone who spent their entire life dedicated to creativity itself. And from there, the process started to become clearer for me, kind of taking a cue from David's brainstorming process. It's almost like I wanted this film to unfold like that creative process itself. And I started connecting the dots, you know, just that's when I really, really started having fun with things and incorporating his music and blending it with reality, right? Visually. And eventually I thought it'd be fun to do kind of my take on Fantasia, but as a documentary, right? I think now to give people a sense of what kind of film it is, I say it's a cross between like Fantasia, Cave of Forgotten Dreams, and Koyaanisqatsi. And only one of those films at the time you know, were in my own database, and that was Fantasia. I hadn't seen those two other films at the time, but in hindsight now, it's kind of, they're the elements of those kind of films that I see in this one.
So you haven't said it explicitly quite yet, but I think we're talking about the blending of documentary and fiction, right? And I broke up with documentaries as a filmmaker after film school because of my own weird proclivities, but I was so obsessed with legacy, right? Doing someone right, doing someone's legacy right. So I'm just curious, what kind of conversations did you have with David when you said, this is not going to be a verite documentary. I'm not trying to reflect you in a literal way. I'm reflecting your experience in a figurative way. Was he just on board, or like, talk about that negotiation process?
I'm similar to my experience leading up to meeting him. He's always been on board, supportive of my crazy ideas. And I think that's also because he's always been very bold with his work and his music. He was experimenting with computer generated sounds, like electronic sounds into his music, doing very avant-garde types of compositions. So he always embraced the unexpected and unpredictable. So he was all for it. And which that only fueled my passion and desire to do a great job. And yeah, like you said, do justice to his story in a way that I feel like it would. A lot of this film was me resisting documentary and particularly reality and conventions at the time. That's kind of how I came up through the industry. I got my foot in the door on a early Hulu docuseries called Behind the Mask, which is about sports mascots. And so I've been working in, you know, editorial or camera departments. That's how I kind of climbed my ranks. But yeah, I just kind of got fed up with not just aesthetics, but, you know, how the story is told. And it was the perfect feature film project for me because it's being about creativity itself. That's a character in the film. I'm having fun with that idea, like and what a documentary should be, for example. So, you know, it's playful in that way.
How do you feel like your career in editing, like, kind of helped you get prepared to make this documentary? Like, what was it about it, by kind of, like you said, rising the ranks? Like, what kind of opened the door for you to take on such a big creative endeavor?
I'm not sure if there was a singular moment, but I had been in LA for going on 4 years, I want to say. And, you know, my end objective has always been to direct. And I just felt like I'm obviously not going to become a director by PAing my way to the top. And I've worked on so many projects. It's my trajectory has been so, like, I've been worked on every single type of project in every single department, I want to say. And at the time, I felt like I have this, I needed to take a shot, more or less. You know, I need to throw a jab out there, a creative jab. And the editing for sure prepared me for this project, because just as it being a documentary, it's so editing intensive. The story is, as they say, is made in the edit. And I think editors naturally are kind of bringing it back to this, the theme of, you know, AI and algorithms. They have an eye for patterns. And so when you spend hours looking at footage, you subconsciously, whether you know you're trying to or not, you can identify certain repetitive shots, themes, or ideas, you know, and we group them in sequences, right? And those together, we kind of naturally do that. We are kind of like algorithms in a sense. So by, you know, having edited a bunch of stuff before, it primed me to take on something on this scale.
I think there's like a lot to talk about in the years of 2019 to 2023 that we haven't even tapped into. And it's like, did you spend 2 years in the festival circuit because of the pushback of COVID and virtual screenings? Or like, it's a giant task that I'm putting in front of you to like explain 4 years in 2 minutes. But I'm just saying, like, what was the best advice you got that led to this theatrical for the film? Like, ramp us up a little bit.
Yeah, I had applied to some festivals before COVID hit. You know, this was my first feature film, and I didn't know what I was doing, you know, so I applied to the big name festivals just because I thought I had to, right? And then COVID hit, and then festivals weren't happening, and I felt like I was stuck in limbo. Like, I had just finished this marathon of a project, and I just felt stuck, and I didn't know anyone close to me around me that could give me advice. So, you know, I took the time when we're all stuck at home to, you know, research and read up on figures in the doc industry that I felt like were like-minded, or, you know, that I could reach out to. And one person was someone named Sean Farnell, and he was the former director at Hot Docs, outspoken advocate for independent filmmakers. And just reading what he's another bold voice and not afraid to speak his mind. So I was like, hey, I like what this guy's saying. I want to reach out and see if he'd be willing to, you know, to offer some advice. And turns out he's been a consultant in Canada for filmmakers, you know, for some time now. So, you know, he was a very integral help in, you know, kind of telling the reality of what it is, you know, like most just the festival circuit and the odds of getting into a top tier festival and where, you know, where our time would be better spent pursuing more niche festivals, since this is, as I've been sharing this film to you, it's hard to really put it into a certain box, right? It's neither this or that. It's fiction, documentary, is it about science or music, you know, all these things. Yeah, he helped me really kind of hone in a list of festivals that were more music film festivals, and strategy, being more intentional with strategy there. And so that actually, yeah, I think the first festival that we got into was one called Decibels, which is part of SF Indie Fest. And that was virtual at the time. And then our next one, we got invited to a festival in France called Rock This Town in Pau, which is in the southwest corner of France. And that was pretty, I mean, for me as a filmmaker, that was pretty unforgettable, because I've never felt so much love before. Just loved not as just a filmmaker and understood, but just as I don't know, an individual over there. It's just, went over there and they got everything. I didn't really have to explain much. The judges came up to me and, you know, we started talking about the film, and everything felt easy and natural. And this is all new to me. I've never done a festival run before, let alone during a pandemic. So that was wild. That whole time, I'll never forget, you know, being invited to that festival. Sorry, I'm kind of like rambling.
I'm getting a little bit about like the specialty festivals and you having a mentor, but I'm still thinking, like, we haven't even said, are you self-distributing this film, or is there like a way that you pitched this film to distributors or did Sean essentially say, fuck that, they're not going to get it, you advocate for your film yourself?
Yeah, we definitely had those conversations, and yeah, getting a traditional distributor, especially in this climate, you know, that wasn't going to be part of the strategy. And so self-distribution was, it was something I wanted to do. But then, you know, I heard some good things about a distributor called Indie Rights. And, you know, I asked other filmmakers about their experiences, and, you know, it would at least put us on a few platforms. And, you know, I'm still learning right now. Like, all the tail end of this stuff, it's still a learning process. So this film, you got to treat it like it's a business that you're always, whenever you have time, you're watering the plant, right? So, you know, now it's kind of like you need certain amount of reviews to, you know, to make it onto Amazon Prime, because we're technically on the Amazon Instant side, the TVOD side, right? So in order for our film to get kicked into the algorithm, so to speak, you know, we need to have a certain amount of reviews, and you know, that's all part of this, you know, the work after you think the film ends, right? But the work never ends.
So I saw that you're going to have a screening in theaters coming up really soon at the end of the month. Like, is that in conjunction with your distribution through Indie Rights, or is that something that you're doing on your own, or is it through someone else? Like, how's that coming together?
That actually kind of fell into our lap. I had no intention of, you know, showing this in the theater at all. I was like, it's on VOD, you know, my, you know, it's out of my hands. But a friend of Greg Lemley emailed me out of the blue one day and said, yeah, he's like, I'm friends with Greg, and he wants to invite you to screen the film at his theaters. And I was like, okay.
But how did he find out about it?
Oh, I mean, this is important detail right there. So his friend was a former student of David's. So I guess, because we screened the film in Santa Cruz last October for our final festival screening was there in David's hometown. So I guess he had gotten wind of the film, and he reached out on Facebook to me. Yeah, here we are a few months later. Screenings happening on the 27th and 28th. Yeah, another kind of, you know, this has all been kind of learn as I go, to be honest. I wish I could give like eloquent, like I had thought all these things, you know, well out in advance, but a lot of it's just been trial and error, to be honest, and being my first feature documentary.
I work in distribution. I'm a sales rep. So I do work similar to what Sean does. I'm aware of Sean, and he seems lovely for you know, whatever I know of Sean. We just had a guest, Dawn Jones Redstone, on the show. She made and was recommended by the same publicist, by the way, by Smart House Creative, who recommended you. And she also was in no hurry to get to distribution. And it's very interesting to me. It's almost like perplexing to me, because as a consultant, I'm working with filmmakers and I'm like, you don't want to be a distressed asset. You don't want distributors to see you as old news. You got to get out there fast. There's this like perceived timeline that in actuality, I think all three of us know doesn't exist, right? It's perceived. It's assumed. It's fabricated. You're proving that it is fabricated with the fact that you had a theatrical distributor just reach out 4 years after you made the movie and says, can you play this? What were you ever worried about time, or was this ever a concern for you? Because you seem very patient with this film, and I would say that is something.
Too patient.
No. I don't know. You've made some smart decisions. I would say most filmmakers feel the need to rush, and you don't seem to feel that.
I think partially it's because I set very realistic expectations from the beginning. Again, this is my first feature film. I don't know what I'm doing. I still kind of don't. So to me, it was the most important thing for me was to have something that at the end of the day, I can say, did my best, and damn, I'm pretty happy with that. And if I died tomorrow, I'd be happy. That's at the top of my list. Everything else is a bonus. And with all the stuff that was happening, you know, I in the world at the time, and still is happening, you know, I always kind of remind myself and try to be grounded in that, you know, as much as all this stuff means the world to me, that it's okay. It's not the end of the world. It's like I can kind of step back and be patient, for lack of a better word, that things will work out in the end.
So now that you've made your first feature-length documentary / fiction film / you know, exploration of creativity, what are you thinking you're going to do for your next project? Like, do you have an idea of like where you want to go next as an artist, or like what kind of thing you want to tackle? Or are you still just sort of waiting for that bit of inspiration for the next thing to grab you, to help you make it, you know?
It's definitely something I've been thinking about a lot lately, because I'm in this in-between space, and this one's kind of a tough act to follow because it was just an ambitious project to pursue, and in all aspects it's hard to top, and I jokingly wonder if I'll be stuck in a you know, like a writer's block or a composer's block like David was, which sparked him to create his own, you know, his program. But I'd like to explore, you know, episodic and serial work, you know, because, you know, I'd like to talk about sustainability as a filmmaker, right? Like that's making movies is hard, but making money making movies, that's, I want to say, is even harder. So,
or near impossible.
Yeah. So, you know, I've had a couple of friends. They're like, why don't you look at, I mean, the work's all in TV and whatnot. And, you know, you hear about, you know, these directors that go in for a day or whatever in a week and make 20K, you know, per week or something. And that sounds really nice. But then at that point, it's like you're kind of in that ecosystem and you're not really, you know, on a show, let's say, for example, I don't know, like a show like CSI. It's a well-oiled machine at that point. You're not really exercising much creativity, I want to say. But I'd like to believe there's some middle ground between that and this, I'm kind of this lone penguin right now, right? Kind of going away from the colony and doing crazy things. But I'd like to think there's some like middle ground there where, you know, as long as I bring back something to the colony, you know, I'll get some food, you know.
Going back to sustainability, you know, you have a very low overhead for this film, but I'm also super hyper aware of the different windows of distribution and how expectations need to be incredibly reasonable for returns for indie filmmakers. Have you hit that point yet? Like, are you at the point where are you idealistic about profiting from this film? Are you ambitious? Have you already profited from it and you just haven't said it out loud on this podcast? Like, where is your mindset in terms of sustainability from this project?
Like I said before, didn't have any expectations to generate much revenue from this, let alone get rich off of it. I think it's for me, it's more of a stepping stone into the next creative step. That said, you know, I've taken the time during all of this to, you know, to explore other alternate paths. And there's a community that I'm a part of called Show and Tell. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure if you're familiar. And
Keith
Akawat. Yeah. He's been very, you know, helpful in supporting PBS underwriting as an avenue for revenue. And that's actually been, I like the idea of applying our creativity to other aspects of this whole process, right? Not just production, or it's, you can also, you know, attempt to go at it from a different way. And I think timing wise, the subject of this film, you know, there's a boom and explosion in AI or generative art right now, and much interest in this topic. So I, in my own experience navigating, you know, PBS and underwriting, I feel there's potential there. I'm not idealistic. I know it's tough. It's not easy. The sponsorship game, you know, and that's a skill set that I've never really tapped into, which is fine. But I take it kind of as a challenge. And when I'm in that kind of mindset, it's kind of fun and enjoyable, actually, because it's so new and exciting that, in a way, you know, ignorance is bliss. I don't know how tough it is, but, you know, I had a friend who, I told him what I'm doing, and he's all up, that's his world. In the VC world, he's all about finding sponsors and connecting people and all that. That's not me. I'm the creative guy. And he was telling me, like, Jay, this is so not you. What are you doing? Like, you shouldn't be doing this stuff. But, you know, I told him, you know what, this is a blind spot for me. And I feel like it's something that I need to learn to get better at regardless. So I'm treating it, you know, with a positive perspective. But again, that, you know, finding sponsors, especially now, the global temperature right now ain't too hot. It feels like, for a lot of people. So it's definitely, you got to put in the work and build relationships for that.
To kind of double down on Liz's question about sustainability, like, what are you doing to pay the bills? Are you just editing and doing freelance gigs? Like, are you able to fulfill keep your creative stuff going while also, you know, having an apartment or a house to live in?
Yeah. I mean, it's always been, I've always been a freelancer ever since moving here, you know, like, it's been 10 over just over 10 years now. And I've been editing more and being the pandemic kind of further put me in that editing, editing work. So yeah, it's always been a combination of camera and editing to pay the bills. But yeah, like I said, we're all trying to figure it out and love to actually direct more, have directing bring money. Yeah. So, right now it's all been on the tail end of this filmmaking journey with this project and getting into the nitty gritty of distribution and now publicity and PR and seeing how it all works, right? And now, but I've also been meeting people on the front end of it, like the development side. And so I'm realizing, okay, there are, just like how there are distributors for certain types of films, there are also, development and production companies that specialize in certain kinds of films too. So,
without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
That these are all kind of things that I'm, just getting deeper into. And while I, work on future longer form, let's say features, which, as you know, move at a glacial pace, those are things that I'm going to have to address and building those relationships, but short term, yeah, it's kind of, I'm nothing sexy. It's just good old freelance work, and getting whatever scraps I can. That's, I'm a very scrappy filmmaker, for better or worse.
Yeah, I was a freelancer for 9 years, so I know what you're talking about. It's whatever comes your way, whatever you can get.
Right. But the work itself has becoming, fortunate to get more interesting types of work now. A friend of mine, actually, he did the sound. He was the supervising sound editor on this film, Mike James Gallagher. He works for a sound effects company called Pro Sound Effects. And he interviewed Chris Nolan's sound designer recently, Richard King. And yeah, he put me on as an editor to help edit some episodes for the company. So that's another cool, it's work, but also interesting at the same time.
Yeah.
Whereas, we've all had our share of not so fun gigs, but
yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
I think it's time for our final six questions. So I'm going to jump it off with, what's the first film you ever made and how do you feel about it now?
First film I ever made was, this is like a student film shot on like a Sony DV cam or something. I think it was called like Sin Number 6. It might even be on YouTube, but I just filmed my friend Greg eating like a burger or something, just like his... And him choking on the burger and dying. That was it. It was just like a very, it was about gluttony, I think, or I don't know what I was trying to do at the time, but it's just, yeah, him chowing down on a burger in almost grotesque fashion and eventually, succumbing to the burger.
What's the best filmmaking advice you've ever received?
Best filmmaking advice. That's a great question. I think... I don't know if it's the best, but it's something that I've thought about because I've heard advice that I didn't completely agree with. And that is, no one else can really get you to where you want to be. And I guess I should give context. It's like, I've always been told network, network, network. And, it's about who you know in this town. And of course, that's a lot of it is relationships, but that makes it sound like people are going to hand things to you or you're not going to have to do most of the work yourself. And so the advice I would like to give is that, no one can get to where you want to be. You have to do most of the work yourself. And if it's not obvious, it's blood, sweat, and tears. It's not easy, And so like, is it worth it to you in the end, because people don't talk about the toll, all the dark side of making films. And being an artist, an actual artist, isn't desirable. Like in LA, people like romanticize that idea and like the image, the idea of being an artist and maybe looking like one and having good taste. But an actual artist, is, you know, you're broke, you're depressed, you know, like it's not pretty. So at the end of the day, it's, you know, have to ask yourself, is it worth it to you? I don't know if that answered your question, but.
Well, the follow-up question is, what's the worst advice you've ever received? Would network be the worst advice?
I think it's on a related note. I think it's not exactly advice, but not letting other people define success for you. And I think that's been a little easier for me, not having grown up in LA and being kind of outside the ecosystem, being a quote-unquote outsider or a lone penguin in a way. I was never afraid to kind of figure it out for myself. And so, yeah, again, it's not a piece of advice that was given to me, but that's something that you made me think of that. Again, yeah, I never minded being the little nimble, scrappy mouse that, you know, as a filmmaker, moving it between, you know, the giants, the elephants that are the studios, you know. You know, at least that's where I'm at now. And that's kind of the path I've been on. It isn't for everyone. And I get it if you don't want it to be that either. But it's something that I've been comfortable doing.
Do you have a goal as a filmmaker?
To make money directing, to make money making films.
Nice.
If you could go back in time and give a piece of advice to yourself, what would it be?
I'd just be kinder to myself, I guess. There's so many things that are within our control, and especially in documentary filmmaking, kind of asking for pain. You know, you've probably heard the expression in narratives, the director is God, but in documentaries, God is the director, right? So especially in docs, nothing is ever going to go to plan, and you just have to, you know, just be kinder to my younger self and trust in the process, patience, which I'm getting better at, you know?
No, I think you have patience locked down, Jay. I don't think you need to work on that from my perspective.
Yeah. So that's the only thing I can think of. It's funny you mentioned patience, because now on the flips, on the business side of things, I'm trying to challenge a more chaotic, kind of impatient, get shit done energy, you know, like, because the creative stuff, I can, you know, it's easy to be this precious and have this purest kind of process to it. But for business, the gloves come off, anything goes, right? So I don't mind, you know, channeling that energy right now.
And final question, is making movies hard?
Yes and no. I think they're not easy, but like I said before, making a living making movies is hard.
Love it.
You did it. You survived the gauntlet of our questions.
Yes. No, thanks so much. This was actually my first podcast, so.
Oh, welcome. Oh,
nice.
Happy to induct you into your newest obsession or addiction. Where do you want to send people, though? Like, are you on social? Like, do you want to direct people to a specific place?
Sure. Definitely follow us on all the social media platforms. Our handle is OPCOPE film. That's also the website as well. Yeah, we got that screening coming up and have a PBS broadcast scheduled later in the year. So definitely follow us and check for updates.
So I think I'm going to get this out on the 27th, just looking at our schedule. So people hearing this tonight at 7:00, if you're in Los Angeles, go to the Lemley Theaters and watch this movie. You can watch it today. And then wait, better yet, if you miss it today, you can watch it tomorrow on Tuesday, the 28th. So come check them out, man.
Yeah.
My little emphatic punch push.
We need that.
I mean, yeah, it's increasingly rare to even see films at a theater these days. So, and this, I envision, you know, like a musical visual experience. So I'm thrilled that it's playing at a theater, let alone Lemley. So yeah, please get out there and watch this film about a very inspirational human being. Thank you.
Do you love Making Movies as Hard and you want to listen to more episodes?
Jump over to our Patreon page at patreon.com/MMIH and you can listen to the entire back catalog of episodes for just $1.99 a month.
That's an additional 300 episodes that aren't on iTunes that you can listen to whenever you please.
But without any more blibber blabber, back to the show!
Alric, what do you remember about our chat with Jay yesterday? Just so long ago yesterday.
I mean, talking about dreamers, he felt like a total dreamer, you know, and just like this artist guy, like wrapped up in his idea of like how to make this film and tell this story. And, you know, his whole freelance background felt very familiar to me, you know. It kind of like felt like looking back to a version of myself that never existed, like being this freelance filmmaking artist person who's like, well, I don't know. I guess I'm just reading in, like, it just seemed like Jay was single, like, maybe he's not, you know,
I don't know.
But just, like, looking at his lifestyle and everything, it just seemed like this, like, a free man just out in the world, like, making his art, working on his projects, and, like, not having to, like, basically account for anything besides himself. It's like, that's the way I saw him. This is probably mostly in my brain and like not actually in reality because we didn't talk about any of those things. Because like when I was a freelancer, I basically had, you know, I was in relationships like basically the whole time. So like, you know, I never really had that like complete 100% like, you know, doing whatever sort of thing.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know. So that's what I took away from just his whole thing. He's like, yeah, I'm just going to go to Santa Cruz and make this movie about this guy and, you know, just do is like really, it seemed very free, you know, his whole experience and his whole art process and everything about what he was doing seemed very free and open, which seemed beautiful. But what about you? What did you take away?
Well, I mean, similar, not, I didn't have the kind of romantic dreams of that, but just the idea that he was so, I always talk about this, he was so calm about his career. And what's weird, we didn't even talk about how we got a pull quote from Penny Lane. Penny Lane is like such a huge deal documentary filmmaker who blends fiction and documentary quite a lot. And it's like, he worked with Sean Farnell. He got a pull quote from Penny Lane. Greg Lemley reached out to him for, you know, theatrical. It's like things kind of came to him. Like he worked for them. But it was just so interesting that he just kept with the project, had faith, and like opportunities were attracted to him. And that's that, as a control freak, that's a very improbable scenario for me to buy into, right? But he's telling me that that's what happens. So it happens, people. It happens. Like you work on your project, you can create opportunities for yourself just by caring and researching and networking in a very low pressure way.
Yeah. I feel like people, I hear that a few times from people on the show where they're like, oh yeah, like I made this thing, someone saw it and they reached out and they hired me to do this thing. I'm like, wow. Will that ever happen to me?
Right.
We'll see. Maybe one day.
Right.
But that seems like the ideal scenario, you know? But yeah, no, it was a fun conversation. I hope you guys all liked it. What I'm really excited to talk about is this new, brand new You're the Expert segment that we've got going on here. This is probably like the third or fourth time that we've done it. This question, well, before I even get to the question, I'm going to explain what it is. So basically, our producer, Eric Toms, has decided that this is a really great idea to have a question that he knows Liz and I are the experts at, or not the, necessarily the experts, but that we're expert enough that we should be able to answer this question and give like a definitive answer that is actionable and correct, basically. So he'll just give us these like little quick like questions and then we just pontificate on them. This week we have a listener who asked us one, Mason Treen. And so this is the first ever a listener asked the first ever listener, you're the expert question. Here it goes. I've finished my first short. It's ready to be shared. What's a first step from a distribution standpoint that I can take to differentiate myself from the thousands of short films, millions, maybe, made every month? What do you think, Liz? What would you do here?
Okay, so this is like such a big question, right? And I feel like we've answered it in different ways throughout the past few years, but we'll try to aggregate like meaningful advice for Mason. I mean, that's why people do film festivals, is to kind of differentiate their film from the millions that come out every month. And sometimes it's worth the expense and the investment of time and energy and money, and sometimes it's not. So the first question is to ask yourself, Mason, like, do you want to invest in a film festival release? If you don't, the second idea is, do you want to pitch your film to a platform like Film Shortage or Short of the Week or No Budge or Omeletto or whatever, and see if they want to premiere your film? Like, when you have an exclusive asset, like a film that hasn't premiered yet, you have a little bit more leverage and power. If you're not interested in that and you just want to put it up on YouTube, then I'm going to say what I always say, which is you build up an audience and a network through your personality, through social media, through newsletter, through in-person events, and you talk about the movie in an emotionally transparent, candid way in an effort to get your network to go and see it and support it. And it would be as simple as picking a release date, doing a countdown via email to the hundreds of names and email addresses you've gathered, and then on your launch date, getting as many people as possible to share, like, tweet, Facebook, view it, and try to engage it in the algorithm of whatever platform you put it on. These are all really big picture piece of advice, so I'd be curious what you want to say, Ulrich.
Well, I'm going to make some assumptions. I'm going to assume this movie has already gone through the festival route and that they've done that and that's been done. I will say that, like, that was probably a time to release the movie online, you know, is like maybe at the last film festival that it premiered at might have been good. Just to, like, use that event to, like, you know, Yes. You know, launch the movie out into the world, basically. But yeah, let's say that ship has sailed, so that can't happen. I love what you're saying about, like, trying to find a platform for it. I feel like I used to be a big fan of trying to do it on your own, you know, Vimeo page or YouTube page to, like, kind of bring people to you and your own thing. But I think unless that is what you want to do with your time, to, like, build up an audience and to, like, build a YouTube channel that you're, like, contributing to, like, once a week with a new video at minimum, then I would say that's probably not the best thing to do. I think you should take advantage of, you know, one of these other services or channels that have, like, you know, that do release movies every week, you know, and, like, have yours be one of those, because then you're going to instantly get, like, way more eyeballs on it. Yeah. And then, you know, you can find an audience that way. So, like, that's probably what I would do, is try to figure out which site makes the most sense, or YouTube channel or whatever, like, makes the most sense for your movie, and then go after them. I think always worth a Film Shortage. Well, let me put it this way. I think Short of the Week is, like, the longest shot in the world, but, like, I do feel like it's also worth it, you know? Film Shortage is much less of a long shot. Like, you know, you're probably going to get into, like, I wouldn't say probably, but I think the chances of you getting into Film Shortage are a lot higher than Short of the Week, you know? So I wouldn't necessarily, like, make that the next, like, instant choice. I would look at, you know, there's, like, if it's a horror movie, like, Alter is a big one, right? Like, that's a really good one to check out. If it's a sci-fi movie, Dust, which is, like, you know, part of the same company, they're a really good one. And then, yeah, I like the one that you said, Omeletto. I remember looking them up. But there's thousands. Well, not thousands, but there's hundreds of these. So, like, I would, like, do a lot of research to figure out, like, which YouTube, like, short film YouTube channel is right for you, and then approach them and then see if your movie makes the cut, you know? And then I would do exactly what you said. Set the release date, do promotion, go after every blog that talks about short films or indie films, every website you can find that does any kind of posting on any of these things, and blast the shit out of all of them. Yeah. Because the more people who are going to talk about you when your movie hits, the better chance you're going to have of, like, you know, getting viral and hitting somewhere, you know? Yeah. I've done this 4 times where I've really tried to push a short film that I made online. And the first time was the most successful. And I think I got, like, 40,000 in the first 2 weeks or something. But, like, every other time, it's been, like, a couple thousand at best.
Which is still really good.
Which is still not bad, right? Which is, like, the funny thing. It's, like, if you could get to 2,000 or 3,000 in the first, like, few weeks, like, you're not doing so terribly, because there's a lot that only get a couple hundred hits after that time. But, like, if you're going to go through one of these platforms, the chances of getting to, like, the 5,000s, the 10,000s, the 20,000s, like, you just have such a better chance of getting up there. If you get, you know, and I wouldn't say chosen, but if you get released through one of these these platforms. So I think that's really the way to do it. And I love what you said about like emailing people and doing countdowns. And I think all that stuff is really helpful because you want to make it like an event and make it a big deal. I'm actually about to do this with a short film that I directed.
Oh, you finally figured it out. You talked about this a few weeks ago.
I mean, I haven't really figured it out, but I do know we're going to do an online release because, you know, my co-director wants to reach as many people as possible, and going through any like sort of like place of like distributing it for money and putting it on any kind of paid platform is A, not going to result in very much, if any, money, and B, hardly anybody will see it,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So if you really want to reach people, like, you got to go with, you know, these channels that people are going to watch content. So I know we already got rejected from Alter, and I believe we got rejected from, you know, Short of the Week. But yeah, there's a lot that we haven't gone after yet. And like, I basically, you know, I love my co-director. She's a wonderful person. Like, I sent her like a list of all the ones. And she was like, you pick. And I'm like, I don't have time for this. Like, I got to like go through and like, you know, so now basically I just decided that like in order for this movie to get released, I basically do have to just do it, you know? So, I mean, I'll do it with her, but like, you know, it's not like clearly she's not going to do it herself. Cause if she would have, if she was going to, she would have done it by now. But yeah, hopefully that helps. Mason, I want to hear about how you decide to release your short, and tell us about it, and we'll give it a little shout out on the show. You can always send us a question, comment, or suggestion to podcast@makingmoviesishard.com. Or if you have a question or a topic suggestion for one of our, either of our new games, the You're the Expert or The Game, you can send those to us as well through that same email address. You can also leave us a review on iTunes if you really love the show. We'd really appreciate that. It's the best way for the show to grow and for more people to find it. So if you are just listening for the first time, you like what you're hearing, iTunes review. That'd be amazing. You can also check us out on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at MMIH Podcast and YouTube at Making Movies is Hard Podcast. Don't forget to check out the International Screenwriters Association, the ISA. They are an organization designed to connect writers with filmmakers through a number of programs they offer. They do consultation courses, contests, and of course, they have their top 25 writers list featuring some of their very best writers. So head over to www.networkisa.org to sign up for free today. Thanks to Jay Shim for coming on the show. Thanks to our editor, Jeff Reimuth, for doing the editing. Thanks to our producer, Eric Thomas, for being awesome. Thanks to Smart House for setting this whole thing up. Don Jones Redstone was another suggestion, you know, from Smart House, which I don't think we credited them properly on that episode. So Smart House Creative, thank you, thank you, thank you for bringing these wonderful guests to us. And we'll talk to y'all next week. Sci-fi horror filmmaker, and my first feature film, The Alternate, is out now on digital and DVD.
Wait, but what about Tubi?
Oh my god. Jesus.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
You know when you're listening to a true crime story that has an unbelievable plot twist that makes you stop in your tracks? That's what our podcast, People Are the Worst, brings you with each episode. I'm Rachel.
And I'm Rebecca. We're identical twins who love true crime cases that make you say, "Didn't see that coming," and we hate the people responsible for them. Listen to People Are the Worst now on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.